Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
Welcome to Word in Your Ear. I'm going to tell you a story. A few weeks ago, I was in Belfast on book promotion duties. And our next guest was the person I talked to on book promotion duties as part of the Cathedral Quarter Festival.
Yeah.
Which I think, Mark Allen, you've been to in the past.
Yeah, with Stuart.
And afterwards, he was very kind enough to take me on his patented Van Morrison tour of Belfast, which if you can speak to him afterwards, and possibly if you speak to him nicely and you buy his book, he might even do that for you. And I do recommend it. And anyway, as he dropped me back at the hotel, he gave me a copy of his book, Trouble Songs, Music and Conflict in Northern Ireland. And I'm going to be perfectly frank with you. I didn't think, oh, that sounds like a rattling good read. But when I get back to my room in the Europa, you know, brackets, most bombed hotel in Western Europe, you know, that they put above the door. But I did read some of that evening, and I read some of it on the rest of it on the plane coming back to the UK. And I found it absolutely enthralling. And we've done many books. We've featured many books on Word in Your Ear. Frankly, none of them are better than this. And I think Mark Allen would agree with me on this. Yeah. It's an extraordinary piece of work. Would you please welcome Stuart Bailey? So, Stuart, why this book now?
I kind of have been picking away at it for a long time. I've written essays about it. I've done interviews. And I had spent 10 years working in a music centre, a big whiskey warehouse, turned it into a music centre. Exhausted when I left it. It turned into a really big admin job, and it was plumbers and spreadsheets. And, and I thought, I just want to write. You know, if I got run over by a bus tomorrow, what would you regret not having done? And I think I have to write The Music and Conflict, but, you know, it's my life story. It's my record collection. It's not really, nobody's done it in any depth. And I thought, okay, I'm gonna do this. So I gave it my best shot.
So is it self-published?
It is. I had an agent. He couldn't get anyone to bite. They all quite liked the idea, but said it wouldn't sell well. I tried some local publishers who wanted vast, you know, 90% of the revenue, and I thought, So British Council came forward and went, it's the 20th anniversary of the Good Friday Agreement. It's, you know, the moment where everyone signed up for a tentative peace. There's an anniversary, there's a big conference, can you get it out in time? And I was going, well, that's 7 months away. Okay, so then I just went underground.
They gave you a focus.
Yeah, so I'd already written chunks of it, and then I thought, okay, time to do it. No.
So you say it's your story as well. Just to give us a bit of background, when and where were you born?
Well, I was born in 1961 in Belfast. Conflict, everything is negotiable about the conflict, but it's October the 5th, 1968, which was the riot and the civil rights march. So I was seven when the conflict started. So I can barely remember what it was like before then. A little bit of, you know, you remember Christmas and things like that, but all of a sudden the town just shut down. Random violence, explosions.
Right.
And then, you know, the 3,700 people died in the conflict. It was horrendous, but it was all that I kind of knew. And you stayed in your own area. There was a ring of steel around the city centre, so the town literally stopped at night. And then sort of punk arrived, and so that was my era. Well, we'll talk about that later. But so music was sort of the resistance to me started in 77, 78. And then, that was sort of parallel to the process of stopping sectarian killings and all the other stuff that happened. So, and all the time on the radio or certain songs, I would have very strong associations with what happened around that time.
Yeah, yeah.
So I just disappeared and got it all out of my system, and bits of stories I remembered, bits of stories I had to ask people what actually happened that year, and all these stories came tumbling out. And I think because we're 50 years away from the start of the conflict, people are starting to say, well, okay, I'll tell you the real story, you know. And there's a wee bit of that sort of, enough time has passed now for people to open up a bit. So I did about 60 interviews, and some of the revelations were really interesting.
Right, yeah. So let's talk about Belfast. Just from what you're driving me around Belfast, I immediately got a picture, obviously, of things that I've just seen reported in newspapers and on the television over the years, you know. But this idea, I can't think of anywhere else in the UK where certain people are associated with certain areas and everybody knows where everybody comes from, and that had a significance. Can you give us a kind of quick idea of that?
Well, Northern Ireland, the state of Northern Ireland came about in 1921. The rising was 1916, and it was put down by the British, and there was a sort of a revulsion at the execution of the leaders, and mostly in Dublin. And but in the end of the day, as in other parts of the British Empire, there was a retreat from the 26 counties of the Republic of Ireland, but the six counties in the north at that stage were primarily, well, there was a majority, 60% Protestant. So there was a kind of a border stitched up and went, well, you guys can stay in the UK or the British part. And that's been contested since 1921. And incredible sensitivities about place, location, history, history books. Education is segregated, areas are segregated. You can see that map, even just where Belfast is, that, you have incredibly fine-tuned what streets you can go down, where you can't go, and how you're going to be interrupted.
It's the anxiety that we hear about in London nowadays with knife crime and young kids and postcode violence and so forth was a fact of life in Belfast.
Yes, yes. And certainly from 68 onwards, it became more segregated. The areas that were mixed one way or the other, they moved.
Yeah.
By accident or design. You probably remember that Andy White song, Religious Persuasion, Protestant or Catholic, said a voice from the crowd. That idea that you can walk down a street and someone will, that's what they're going to ask you.
Yeah.
What tribe are you from?
Yeah.
And your answer could seriously impact on your health that evening, very stressful.
They some of the stuff in the book I love most is the stuff kind of pre-Troubles, I suppose. It's just about the how music is part of the fabric of everyday life and politics and sectarian tension and all kinds of things, Talk about that.
Well, I think, first of all, folk music is so deep in the culture. In England, you've got your Fairport Conventions and your Lindisfarnes and everything else. But folk music is just it goes back 3, 4, 5 centuries.
You wouldn't start a fight by singing an English folk song, would you?
No, you probably wouldn't, no. So there's also a culture in folk music where they adapt the lyrics. They keep the tune, but they write new lyrics. So when popular music came along, they went, well, we'll do the same with these songs, so... This is Dublin. This is O'Connell Street. And
give us some examples of that, because there are things like I was born under a Union Jack. Is it that?
Yeah,
kind of thing?
Yeah.
We all live in a fascist regime.
Yes. I was born under Union Jack, which was the other thing that happened in the 70s was the small onset printing press. So.
Yeah.
Fanzines became popular, or community newspapers, and each tribe had their own community papers, and it was just lyrics, a song to be sung to the tune of, so when I was 11, it was the big Coca-Cola in on the hillside in Italy. I'd like to buy the World of Coke.
And
I remember going to school and this being in my rucksack. It was I'd like to buy the Pope a rope and hang him from a tree. With Bernadette and Jerry Fitt to keep him company, you know. And each verse had different nationalist leaders and how they would die, you know. It was... Yeah. But this is Nelson's column. The 50th anniversary of the Easter Rising was 66, and that's when things started to get a bit... There was a celebration. It was a very martial celebration in Dublin. And Nelson was on top of that column, and Republicans blew Nelson off. And there was a whole series of songs about it, you know, because they thought, this is great, let's write about it. But Up Went Nelson was the big one. And
that was a number one record.
It was a number one record.
Up Went Nelson.
How did it go?
Up Went Nelson in old Dublin. It was a battle hymn of the Republic, so it was kind of cheering about how all along O'Connell Street, you know, blah, 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 Up Went Nelson, the pillar too. The Dubliners had a song, the Clancy Brothers had a song, but... this was a guy called Billy McBurney from Belfast who wrote Up Went Nelson, and it was recorded by the Go Lucky Four, I think, and it was number one in the 50th anniversary of the Rising, and, you know, Nelson was gone, and that was it, you know. So, so all the time people were rewriting popular songs. Internment was 1971. And hundreds of nationalist stroke Republicans were put in jail without trial. Yeah. The loyalists would sing the "Chirpy Chirpy Cheep Cheep, Where's Your Daddy Gone?" to the nationalists. You know, so that was brutal, really brutal stuff. Yeah. So.
But there was a kind of music industry, wasn't there? In Belfast, a small music industry.
Well, the guy who wrote Up Went Nelson was this legendary man called Billy McBurney, and I met him, you know, in his later years, and he was a total opportunist. He would record Glasgow Ranger songs, Linfield songs, Glentoran songs, Republican anthems, Protestant marching bands, whatever there was. Yeah, it was literally, he had like, you know... The
new lyric sheet.
They had the equivalent of the Wrecking Crew, and it would be like, what have you got in this afternoon? Yeah. Oh, we've got a Kick the Pope band, and you go, okay. You know, it's all in
it's
it.
All
you
work.
Know, a few bob, and I thought that was very charming in a sense, you know. And he literally went, "We're an ecumenical lot. We'll just, as long as there's a few dollars in it, we'll have a go." Yeah.
You talk about You talk about discos. I think in the 60s, that there was always some tension about which national anthem you would finish.
Yeah. Literally, if you were a DJ, you had to carry the Soldier Song and God Save the Queen. And
you'd never
depend on
knew.
Which area you lit. Well, yeah, you know, you had by the end of the night, you kind of knew. And you would go, and there was a guy called Tendy who's in the book who was a DJ, and he'd forgotten, you know, the Republican anthem, we'd forgotten God Save the Queen, and he was in a loyalist area in Donaghadee, and they said, right, God Save the Queen. He says, I forgot the record, and he went, sing it.
So
DJ Henry had to stand on the stage and sing God Save the Queen.
He was worried about being asked to sing verse 4.
Yeah, well, that was it. Yeah. Which was a struggle for most of us. Yeah.
So, as you say, all started to change in the late 60s, the civil rights marches and We Shall Overcome. And music is an important part of that, isn't it?
Yes. Civil rights originally wanted to be beyond regional politics. So they said, we don't want flags. We don't want you to sing nationalist anthems like Kevin Barry. We want to, you know, unite everybody in a... You know, some of these people are very left-wing. They're Trotskyites. And the issues are housing... one man, one vote, you know, in 68. Still didn't have one man, one vote in Northern Ireland. It was crazy. It was a lot of gerrymandering. So the Civil Rights March, and it was kind of like, what are we going to sing? And it was a guy called Finbar O'Doherty. They occupied the Craigavon Bridge in Derry in July 1968. And he conducted everyone to sing We Shall Overcome. You know, nobody quite knew about it. And they, you know, people these days talk about cultural appropriation. You know, and they're going, this is sort of part of the American black struggle. How can we sing this? And it clicked. It worked. And I get very emotional when you hear people, you know, there's clips of those marches and you can hear people in a very strong Irish accent singing "We Shall Overcome." Yeah. And I even spent a bit of time working out how that song had evolved from a gospel song, "I'll Overcome Someday," to "We Shall That's Overcome." Right. And it was it was nurtured and tweaked. It became a union song and then it became a civil rights song. And so this was the big march in Derry on 5th of October 1968, and that's when the Royal Ulster Constabulary got the coshes out, really, and just led into everybody. And I met the person who did the X-rays on everyone, and they were all head concussion, where people were being hit on the head. RTE cameras caught it, so there's incredible footage of just civil rights marches being battered. And in a very short space of time, the Burn Tullet March was January 69, People's Democracy March, and that was basically there was an ambush on the way into Derry, and hundreds of people were battered, and it was all planned, and people from the B Specials, who were like the military branch of the state forces, kind of absolutely So that was it. And then the night of that, Jim Sharkey, father of Fergal Sharkey, who was an electrician, put together Radio Free Derry. So they got a pirate radio station on Rossville. It was in Craigan and in Rossville Flats. And the security forces must have transcribed the first 2 days of broadcast of Radio Free Derry. So I went I went into the public records office and read the transcription, so I knew every song that they played, all the patter, people like Eamon McCann playing these records, and they were playing the Beatles, and they were playing It's Now or Never by Elvis, and then they were playing local artists like Magella Brady, and it was a folk song that had just been written and was pressed up, and they played that. And so that idea that music was just so visceral, so absolutely in the grain of what was going on, and by following the songs, you could almost find the stories.
Yeah, yeah. So then, as you said earlier, that things start getting really terrible and people are moved around. They have to move out the houses for fear of what might...
Well, they change
this produces this very famous image, which, of course, is on the first Dexys Midnight Runners album cover, isn't it?
Well, I thought when I saw that first that was World War II.
It looks like that,
Certainly this gentleman, he looks, it looks like 1941
It does.
He looks like an evacuee. That's Anthony O'Shaughnessy, and that's the Ardoyne. And essentially, the narrative that I've got is basically the Protestants were moving out of a mixed area. This is a coal lorry that they'd kind of hijacked on the Shankill. They came up, they got all their guys onto the coal lorry and all their stuff. And then they set fire to the houses so the Catholics couldn't move in. And this is the O'Shaughnessy family. That's his brother there and his mother at the back. And that's another brother. And obviously he's just going, what the hell? This guy on the left apparently is a guy called Basher Bates, who later was imprisoned he was part of a murder gang called the Shankill Butchers, who operated butcher's knives and carved up mostly Catholics who were on their way home from the pub or from work. So it's just every level of that.
Yeah. But it's bizarre that I suppose that this is just a sign of something that you deal with a lot in the book, is the kind of the reception of these events in the rest of the UK, that there's a kind of war chic that kind of comes along with this, that everybody's very attracted to these images in a strange way, we'll come to that later on. You talk also about the musical reactions of people outside the Northern Ireland. So Paul McCartney and John Lennon both decide that they're going to write songs about what's happening.
And also John Lennon comes out in support of the IRA, doesn't he?
Yes. McCartney was out first, which I think piqued John Lennon, because McCartney literally... This was 1972, so Bloody Sunday is January 1972, and the British paratroopers shot 14, killed 14 civilians on a march, all unarmed. And McCartney literally went in over the weekend and recorded Give Ireland Back to the Irish with Henry McCulloch, who was from Port Stewart. He had previously played with Joe Cocker and the Grease Band and stuff. And he hated it, but it was his first gig with Paul McCartney.
Yeah. He called it a cotton wool protest.
Yes. And it is classic cod reggae. It's a very bad song.
But I know how we reacted, but how did people in Northern Ireland react to that? I mean,
well, I think Henry's brother ended up, a couple of the McCulloch brothers ended up having to fight their way out of bars and stuff like that. You know, it was perceived to be bad form. You couldn't hear it on the radio. There was a complete broadcasting ban on Give Ireland Back to the Irish, but it was number one in Ireland. It was the men behind the wire for 3 weeks. It dropped down and Give Ireland Back to the Irish, and then the men behind the wire went back on. So that whole period of post-internment, Bloody Sunday, the Irish charts were dominated by songs about the shortcomings of the British.
How did people react to John Lennon with the support of the Irish?
Well, I think it was a horrendous. So he had the luck of the Irish, which was a kind of a raped by the British brigands, and it was radical chic. He was sort of winging it a little bit. There wasn't a lot of musical content in what he was doing. He was hanging around with kind of Irish Americans in New York, singing in an Irish New York American accent, and Sunday Bloody Sunday, it's very angry, it's very to the point. He sang about repatriation of the Anglo jocks and Scotties, you know, the Anglos and the Scotties, and then he sort of so that was a very short period of time, and then he was applying for his green card or whatever, and the CIA says your card's marked, buddy, and he sort of moved on.
His mind game.
And Paul McCartney had a little lamb straight after that. So
they've never had long attention spans. Yeah.
A lot of people will say that this was an anti-internment march. It was actually the Oz supporting the Oz trials or whatever. So it was more a march to Marble Arch, and he's holding the Red Mole magazine, and it's an article about the
IRA.
By the IRA.
There's a very moving bit where Rory Gallagher comes to play in Belfast, and the statistics are absolutely astonishing. I had no idea. If I'm right in saying that in 1972, there were 500 deaths in Northern Ireland.
Yeah, yeah.
There were 2,000 bombing incidents. Yeah. I think there were 10,000 shooting incidents.
Yeah.
And I think in just July alone, I think 100 people were killed. You know, so when Rory Gallagher came, and there's this really extraordinary coverage in the Melody Maker at the time. It was, you know, to have the bravery to come, you know, from south of the border to play in Belfast. Yeah. It was quite a risky operation, wasn't it?
Yeah.
You weren't there, I guess.
I would have been 9 or 10 around that time. Rory didn't, you know, he's a very modest chap. He didn't make a fuss. He didn't grandstand about it. He just did the gig. And you know, for that generation, he's virtually a saint. You know, he did it. He appeared. It was generally around Christmas time, New Year's Eve, New Year's Day. The other remarkable one was Led Zeppelin, who played the Ulster Hall, premiered Stairway to Heaven in Belfast. You know, they sang about a bustle in your hedgerow, and at the end of it all, John Bonham goes to the promoter, any riots on tonight? And Jimmy Akin, the promoter, took him to a riot off the Falls Road, you know. So John Bonham got to see a nice riot at the end of the gig.
Great. And then they never came back, did they?
Yeah, they didn't. No, that was it.
The people in Northern Ireland remembered the people who went, didn't they? Is that fair to say?
There was a great loyalty, and it was very few and far between.
You talk about Marmalade came.
There was a Pop for Peace concert in 69, and they tried their best, and I think they almost felt like that John Lennon owed them one, and
but John Lennon, he wasn't coming.
No,
Marmalade,
Marmalade played, And Horace Lips again were an Irish band who turned up and did the necessaries, and huge affection for Horace Lips as well.
So, one of the core events in the book, and an appalling tragedy, is what happened to the Miami Show Band. For the benefit of people who don't know what happened, tell us.
Well, I mean, the show bands were more of a 60s thing, and it was a very Irish thing, and it was kind of state-approved, church-approved, where bands would tour around dry venues, ballrooms,
yeah,
and they would play the hits of the day. They would play Beach Boys songs and, you know, people like Joe Dolan and you know, Big Tom and all of these kind of people, a wee bit of country, a wee bit of rock and roll, party. They would all do synchronized dancing. They would tell jokes. And they were huge. You know, there was thousands of show bands. By 75, it sort of, you know, dribbled away a bit, but still, Miami were the Dublin show band du jour. They were huge in their day.
They had seven number ones, didn't they?
Yes,
yeah, they're massive.
Dickie Rock was the original singer, and the girls would come up to him and say, "Spit on me, Dickie." And that was you know, that was anything from Dickie Rock was kind of so. But by 75, the glory days were over. They didn't have the big coach anymore. They had a Volkswagen van. They were on their way from a gig in Banbridge. They were going to Newry, on their way back to down south. And what they assumed was a British Army checkpoint, people in Army uniforms on a bus kill. They got out of the van. The soldiers were looking around inside the van. And it turned out that it wasn't the UDR, the Ulster Defence Regiment, it was the UVF, who were a paramilitary gang. And they were planning to put a bomb under the driver's seat, fully expecting it to go off an hour later when they were in the south. And why, nobody's really explained, but certainly I think they wanted to create a hard border and they wanted to stoke up tension. And there was a lot of state collusion going on at the time, and the Glen Ann gang, who were responsible, also did the Dublin Monaghan bombings that Bono later wrote about. But the bomb went off. The two guys trying to put the bomb in the van were killed instantly. The remainder of this bogus army immediately started to kill. So they shot three members of the Miami Show Band at point-blank range. Fran O'Toole, the singer, got 22 bullets, mostly in the head. One of the other guys, the horn player, was shot in the scrotum at point-blank range with a handgun. And it was grotesque. Two of the guys survived. I spoke to them in the book. And, you know, a few people have been arrested for it, but the story's never been told. And almost every month now, there's another bit of, the evidence has been destroyed, or... So it will come out. I think a lot of the collusion stories and the dark state stories will come out. But that was grotesque. And there was a few bands playing at the time, and everyone just cancelled their tour plans. We're going, "We're not going to play in Northern Ireland. That's just crazy. Yeah. They're a bunch of psychos."
Yeah.
So, you know, that was sort of why I was 15 at the time. So that was... You were kind of going, okay, well, that's, you know, you don't go to gigs, really. That's not part of your culture anymore.
So people stayed indoors. I mean, the recorded music industry, you say, did quite well because people couldn't go anywhere.
And a lot of the bars that were blown up became shebeens. So that's where you would hear your Wolf Tone songs and the equivalent on the other side. So it became a bit more embittered and certainly very ghettoized.
Yeah, yeah. So you got the Miami Show Band, are appalling victims of this appalling attack, who were the kind of least fashionable looking, least chic group you've ever seen in your life. And then you start getting kind of the Clash come over in 1977, 78 or whatever.
Yeah, October 1977. And this is the gig that never happened. And it was a long story, but I think the Clash were just bad news in terms of gig insurance, because it was the White Riot Tour had
just
happened
before that.
And before that, obviously, was the Anarchy Tour. So insurers in England didn't want to know them. And I think, you know, there was 20,000 quids worth of damage in a Glasgow gig and all of that stuff. But then you put that in a Northern Ireland account. So the insurers wouldn't touch the gig. The Ulster Hall was a city council property, and they were going, "Well, there's no insurance, there's no gig." And the Clash were largely unaware of this. This was in the afternoon. So Adrian Boot, CBS Records had paid him to come over to do some promo shots against the wall in the hotel. And he went, well, let's go out for a drive, you know. So this is just outside Crumlin Road Jail. And this guy's called Keith, the soldier with a moustache. Joe Strummer had picked up a conversation with him. And I guess it is radical chic. Certainly people were very conflicted at home at the time. It was like, you know, is this a publicity stunt?
CBS were mortified that he'd done it. And then and then pressed up loads of pictures and gave them free to all the music press.
So the Clash, you know, they're just saying, look, we're showing the rest of the world what's going on here. It's part of the UK. But it certainly was a moment. And I think the takeaway for the local community was that they had a bit of a riot outside the Ulster Hall on Bedford Street. A couple of the guys were going, and in Belfast terms, it was like 2 out of 10. There was nobody killed, or there was no mortar bombs or whatever. You know, there was a few broken windows and, you know, a couple of people arrested.
Call that a riot.
Yeah. But it was literally, it was us against the system, you know. So it was almost a different war going on, or a different conflict that was like, the youth culture versus the other lot, and that led fairly directly to Alternative Ulster by Stiff Little Fingers.
Right.
That was almost like, well, here, we've got our own tribe here. We don't have to belong to Nationalist, Republican, or Loyalist, Unionist. So that was a revelatory moment.
Yeah, I love the detail about Stiff Little Fingers. You say that that they used to play in the early days, before the Stiff Little Fingers. What were they called before that?
Highway Star.
Highway Star.
Deep Purple.
I rest my case. Yeah. Yeah. Highway Star. Yeah. They used to do Ohio by Crosby, Stills and Nash and Young. But they didn't know that it had been anything to do with the Vietnam War, or they just liked the tune.
Yeah. And it was only a few chords in it.
But you start to get at this time, you know, the emergence of live music in Belfast again, do you? I mean, Rudy?
Yeah. So just outside the Ring of Steel is the city centre. There was, I think, 16 major metal framework things that stopped you getting in and out of the town. But just outside, out on Hill Street, there was a bar called the Harp Bar. And the Harp Bar was official IRA strippers and punks. It was kind of it was kind of CBGBs with extra scary bits, kind of, and sleaze. And that was the gaff, you know. It was an incredible place. It stank. It was filthy. It was everything that was, you know, that rock and roll should be. And that's where bands like Rudy, Stiff Little Fingers, The Undertones, I think, played once. The Fall came over. Monochrome Set. So all of a sudden, there was a home. There was a focus. And, you know, you had to go through chicken wire and security fencing, and, you know, people had been killed in 75 in the Harp Bar. And Rudy were just this magnificent, cool, you know, probably 75, 76, they were already playing Boland songs and, you know, listening to the New York Dolls. And so you know, every town had a cool band kind of thing, and Rudy were the cool band. And Big Time was the first release on Good Vibrations Records. So Terry Hooley, this lovely crackpot individual, and this is kind of opposite where the Europa Hotel would have been. So, you know, they called it Bomb Alley. So, there's literally a daily explosion around here. And he put a record shop in the middle of it all, bless his heart.
Yeah.
And that's where you hung out every Saturday. You know, you literally stayed all day in the first floor of the record shop.
Was there a good spirit amongst these people who were starting a live music scene? Or were they competitive?
It was a little bit bitchy. There was a little bit of a, you know, who was there in 77, you know, that way, which, you know, happened in all the punk communities, I think. But also you were meeting people from the other side of town who you would never otherwise have met, because, you know, you know, if you're East Belfast or North Belfast, you get married, you get buried, you get it, you know, you have a job there, or you sign on. So all of a sudden you're going, you know, that you've got an Iggy Pop badge, or you know,
right?
You know, I saw you in the record shop the other day, and so you're literally meeting people from 2 miles away that you would never ever have met otherwise. So
yes.
it was, and it broke down barricades. It was very exciting. And, you know, Stiff Little Fingers became political, you know, that singing Suspect Device and Alternative Ulster. Rudy used to sing songs like Excitement or Big Time was their big anthem, but Time to Be Proud was this incredible song of we're it, we're the centre of everything that's great. So,
and Stiff Little Fingers are brilliant at using press. They yes. contact journalists and say, don't write another review until you've seen us. We are the greatest rock and roll band in the world.
Yes.
Whatever. And then press up cassettes, I think, of Suspect Device with printed wiring from actual explosive devices.
Yes, right? Gordon Ogilvy worked for the Daily Express, so he was sort of managing them,
yeah.
co-managing them, and also helping to write the lyrics. And I was, you know, at the time was like, how dare he, you know, and other people are going, well, yeah, that's good, you know. And obviously a lot of it came from the Clash, the Riot Zone rhetoric and the drama.
Yeah.
And but at the same extent, you know, those songs are great, you know. Were they contrived? Possibly, but I think Jake Byrne sang it like he meant it, and he wrote quite a lot of the big ones. And to hear John Peel, bless him, Seymour Stein was talking about him earlier, but suddenly from a little inward-looking culture to hear Suspect Device being played on network radio and to hear Teenage Kicks being played and to see Terry Hooley waving bits of plastic around going, look, we did this ourselves. It was very, very liberating.
Yeah.
Because
the Undertones, the cover of the of Teenage Kicks,
yeah.
of the original one, you know, which got the graffiti on the wall saying the Undertones are shit.
Yeah,
really just funny. Seems like the most Northern Ireland thing I've ever seen.
Yeah,
in my life.
And that was in Derry. Derry says, Derry balanced people have a chip on each shoulder, yeah. you know, but
yeah.
they, he says, I've never seen, he says, you were walking on the road and people would cross the road to spit on Fergal Sharkey, you know. It was like, they just, you know, and then Fergal gave as good as he got. So, you know, and obviously Derry has made its peace with the Undertones, but it was just that cultural cringe and anxiety about anyone who seemed to do something out of line or out of step or to be too confident. And it had taken a long time to get over that, you know. So this was a time when this was kind of happening. And I remember being in the shop and literally watching Fergal, because they were like origami, you know.
Yes.
you had to yeah. fold the cover.
Yes. Yeah. Make it yourself.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. So every Saturday, you know, you were conscripted into, you know, people were there folding the sleeves. Whoever.
Yeah.
And, you know, they would fold each other's sleeves. And, you know, it was a cooperative spirit as well. And it was just, you know, they were ridiculous looking sleeves, but
yeah. You write quite a lot about Christy Moore,
yeah,
as a man whose, you know, entire kind of musical career has been bound up with that struggle. Tell us about him.
Well, he was, you know, he's the Woody Guthrie of Ireland, I think, really, and he was. He went from being a bit of a stage paddy and singing, you know, ballads about being drunk, to saying, oh, you know, there's stuff going on here. How do we write about it? How do we articulate it? And in 1981 was the hunger strikes. So it was 10 people died on hunger strike to try and get political status, which was being taken away from them. Their argument, again, none of these arguments are ever simple, but 1981 was a horrendous year because literally people were dying. When it was,
this was Bobby Sands.
Bobby Sands, yeah. was the first to die. I think it was May the 5th, 1981. And then they were staggered. So every couple of weeks, another one died, another one died, another one died. And Margaret Thatcher was making a stand going, never, you know, we're not going to do this. And we're not going to talk to these people. We're not going to manage it. And Christy then, at that point, was in a band called Moving Hearts. And I just toured Ireland for a year. And they recorded various songs of other people's. No Time for Love, On the Blanket, And again, it was a time that I'd almost blocked out. You're kind of going, because, you know, 81, I was 20, and you kind of, and I was at college, and things became bitter and polarized. And you just listen to the stuff that he recorded around that time, and it was so raw and so powerful. And, you know, I'm trying not to judge anybody in the book, because I feel like I don't want to moralize too much. But, you know, Christy Moore, and subsequently Christy Moore has sort of moved into a little bit of the center ground. But
yeah.
he absolutely took a stance around that time.
Yeah. So when did you come? You came to the UK to work on The Enemy?
I came 85 to London, and I stayed until 96. And I think the 80s really, and I'd been in bad punk bands, and I played in the Heart Bar and the Pound Club, and loved it. And then, you know, realised I was never going to be a rock and roll star, and came to London with a typewriter. But the 80s felt hopeless. It felt like there was no movement, no give, nothing. So it was, you know, and a lot of people emigrated around that time. Uh-huh. So there was huge colonies and North London and South London and stuff of people who kind of needed a break.
And you probably thought you wouldn't go back, did you?
I went back a lot, you know, to see family and stuff, but it was, well, I don't know. And then you get a bit older and, you know, and around early 90s, there was starting to be a bit of a give. The ceasefires were, the IRA ceasefire was 94. The Cranberries put out Zombie, and then the Loyalists put down their guns. I went, that's enough. You know, no more bad songs, you know. So 94, and I was back in 96, and it got a bit giddy. Andy White says it went a bit fluffy for a while, because people almost a little bit, shall we give this a try?
Right.
And this is the moment then in 1998. They put together the Good Friday Agreement. The plenary sessions, there were 14 different political parties and voices, and they bashed down. George Mitchell kind of knocked heads together on behalf of the Americans. They signed up the Good Friday Agreement, and then there was a referendum in May. And a lot of political prisoners were coming out, or they were on early release, or they were on remand, and there was a lot of grandstanding at political events, and the moderate vote were completely spooked, going, what are we signing up to? These guys taking applause and being called, you know, the Nelson Mandelas of Ireland and all of this kind of thing. And there was an utter panic. It was like, what are we going to do? If this vote goes down to Swanee, we've nothing. The peace process is dead in the water. So very quickly, somebody put the word out to Bono through the John Hume's STLP. Bono says, well, I'll do a gig, but there's got to be a Northern Ireland dimension. So they got the band Ash, who were very much cool little band at the moment. They put a gig on at the Waterfront Hall. It was 2,000 sick farmers. And U2 had come off Pop Mart, one of the most technologically over-engineered tours ever. And all of a sudden, they were playing borrowed instruments on the Waterfront stage. And, you know, the bootleg of it, the music's awful. You know, they played Stand By Me, they played Don't Let Me Down, they played One, which is one of those incredible songs that lends itself to any occasion. But the handshake, or this was a kind of remake of the Bob Marley,
Edward Sciaga, and Michael Manley. Yeah.
So, you know, and I think Bono was very aware of that. But, you know, that was the moment. Banks of TV cameras and stuff, and that was the cover image on all the papers the next day. So a rock and roll gig completely changed the news agenda. It was incredible. Like, and the guy from the Unionist Party said there was nothing left in the tank. We had nothing left to offer. We had all the news was bad. The opposition to the agreement, which was mostly Ian Paisley and stuff, were winning the story. And a rock and roll gig saved the future.
We just need a gesture.
It literally made it, you know, and the fact that it was children at the gig, suddenly youth was on the agenda and the future was on the agenda. And so it was a very pragmatic moment, really.
Yeah. So post Good Friday Agreement, you know, slowly things thaw out and, you know, some kind of normal life is resumed. I know from my experience of being in Belfast a few weeks ago, It's like any other city in the UK. On a Saturday, it's absolutely full of hen parties.
Yes,
and people negotiating huge limousines down the... It's part of the booze economy that keeps the UK going.
Beer bikes, yeah. And in a sense, you're kind of going, is this what we fought the punk wars for? You know, so that people could cycle down the road drinking beer. You know, hen parties.
Huge pink limousines.
You know, and you know, the cultural areas that we were all part of 10 years ago and around the cathedral and stuff have now been totally gentrified. And you know, it's the neoliberal takeover of Belfast. So, but you know, certainly this was... Europe Music Awards 2012, I think it was, in and there was a potential audience of 1.2 billion. Justin Bieber came to town, and everybody went giddy, and the Chili Peppers played, and this is Snow Patrol.
So probably. Snow Patrol, who are now officially the most successful musical export from the Northern Ireland, surely?
Yeah, they are. Yeah, and you know. Take Back the City was one of the songs that sort of articulated that time. It's like, okay, we'll take it from here, which of course we didn't. You know, the capitalists took back the city, but Just Say Yes again. It was a song about trying to redesign the language of discourse because everybody says no in Northern Ireland. So music has had its part, and. Yeah, no, I didn't write too much about post 1998 because it's almost too early to call but certainly music has copper fastened the piece. Music has been used in all the tourist board ads and all of that. So are we fluffers for the capitalist takeover? I don't know yet. I think we'll have to wait and see how that kind of works. But certainly the normality of the city is... something that someone my age would you know, I've got three daughters, so I'm glad they don't have to live through what I had to live through.
Sure. The climax of Stuart's tour of Belfast that he took me on a few weeks ago is, of course, Cypress Avenue.
Yeah.
Which is this fabulous, beautiful residential street where Ian Paisley used to live, is
that's
that right?
That's right, yeah. It's briefly. The closest thing Belfast has to a Parisian boulevard. there's 85 trees, it's kind of quite wide and stately. Van Morrison lived around the corner in a little labourer's two up, two down, you know, terraced house, and he wrote beautifully about it on Astral Weeks. And on his 70th birthday, so that was 31st of August 2015, he played two gigs on Cypress Avenue. They put a stage at the end of the road and he played in the afternoon and then played in the early evening.
And did he play the song Cypress Avenue?
Hell, he didn't.
It's classic, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
It's hilarious.
He played on Hindford Street, which is as close as you'll get. But yeah, you know, and I think in a very cool way, Van has been part of that, you know, and the Northern Ireland office. There's a line at the end of the song, Coney Island, wouldn't it be great if it was like this all the time? And around 1998, they asked his permission to use that, and that was almost the slogan. We're kind of like, it's okay, like we're getting there, you know. And he played with. When the Clintons came over to turn on the Christmas tree lights and stuff. So in his own undemonstrative way, he's part of the you know, the paradise regained, you know, from 68 Astral Weeks is a beautiful record to now, you know, it's a big cycle.
Well, there you go.
Fantastic.
He's one of many unforgettable characters in this book, which I really can't recommend too highly. Stuart, Trouble Songs, Music and Conflict in Northern Ireland. Would you please show your appreciation to Stuart Bailey? And Stuart came over this afternoon with a backpack full of books because it's not actually published in the UK, although you can probably buy it online, I'd say.
Yeah, get it on Amazon, yeah.
And so he can't carry a load back. So lighten his load and treat really yourself to one of the most extraordinary books of the year. Stuart Bailey.
Thank you.
This podcast was brought to you by The Word,